McGovern and Rounds took off for Capri along with some of the crew. Radio operator Kenneth Higgins was one of them. Like everyone, Higgins had been bored at Cerignola. "When we didn't fly a mission, there wasn't a lot to do," he recalled. The weather precluded any softball games or other outdoor exercise. Occasionally, the crew would go to the target range and practice with their 45s, but there wasn't much fun in that. "So, we would sit around and argue with each other and play cards or dice. One time we said, no more cussing. Everybody cusses all the time, so the first guy that does cuss has to put some money in the pot. Well, that lasted about 10 minutes. Being a Texan, Higgins always wore a pair of cowboy boots, whether he was in the plane, on the ground, or on leave. When he got to Capri, he kissed the ground and had a big glass of fresh milk. Italian kids came up to him to ask if he was a girl with those long boots and big heels and leather jacket. "No," Higgins replied. He said he was just a cool cat. He, too, rested and rejuvenated. He got ready to return to the war. 55 years later, when he was being interviewed, Higgins said that whenever things were going bad at work or home in his post-war career, he would settle down by thinking of the guy at the airfield who woke him up in the morning at 4 o'clock to say, "Get dressed and go fly a mission." There is nothing worse than that. So they could call him whatever names they wished in Capri, Higgins decided. He was going to enjoy himself. Everyone did. Lieutenant Ted Withington, a pre-war Harvard student who was, by late 1944, a B-24 pilot in the 780th Squadron, wrote his parents about his experience. "Talk about wonderful vacations," he declared. "Nothing to do we don't want to, and lots of interesting things to do if we care to. It was a week of luxury with no worries." He stayed in the AAF villa on one of Europe's most beautiful isles. He had taken a steamer from Naples, out into the Bay of Naples, past Pompeii and Vesuvius, and out to Capri at the mouth of the bay. He had a lovely room overlooking the sea, complete with balcony. Most blessed of all, "You sleep as late as you want to in real large beds with pillows and sheets. Maid and waiter service all the time. This ain't the Army." Radio operator Bob Hammer of the 742nd Squadron got to Capri right after New Year's. He loved it, especially that, except for booze, everything was free. There was a dance each night, alternating officers and enlisted men. Sergeant Hammer and his pilot went to all of them by wearing each other's uniforms. In the morning, they overslept and missed the ferry going back to the mainland. Again, the next day, they slept late. After missing the ferry 3 times, they finally caught it and then lucked out by catching a B-24 back to Cerignola. Fearing a court-martial, they were, on the contrary, not even reprimanded, as the 742nd had flown no missions due to weather while they were gone. As Lieutenant Withington put it, this wasn't the Army. McGovern and Rounds stayed on Capri for 3 days. They rode the funicular, took a tour of the Blue Grotto, and examined the ruins of Roman Emperor Tiberius's castle. The second night, one of his enlisted crew got drunk and into a brawl. McAfee, the ball turret gunner who was present, recalled that the culprit wound up in the pokey on Capri, and McGovern had to get him out. McGovern and Rounds decided that there was not enough action on Capri, so they hopped on a boat that was just crossing to Naples, where they caught a train to Rome. They registered at the Regina Hotel, which had been taken over by the AAF, and is still in operation in a grand style in the 21st century. In 1945, every night, starting at 6 p.m., the whole ground floor of the lobby was turned into a dance area. Girls from Rome were there, after passing through a screening by the AAF authorities designed to keep teenagers away. Most of the women were in their mid-20s. They were beautiful, but they were caught up in the desperation that comes to many civilians in a war zone. Many were educated, spoke at least some English, had lost husbands, fathers. Beer, vodka, scotch, gin, and more was flowing. There were free bedrooms upstairs. The fee for the women was $30. But they would take payment in cigarettes or mattress covers. These covers were very popular because the women could make clothing for all the family from them. Rounds had a great time, of course, but he also got up with McGovern each morning to go on foot for 10 or 12 hours of sightseeing, looking at every art gallery, every church, every statue, using their guidebook every day for 7 days. Rounds accounted for his interest in the city by explaining to McGovern that his father had told him if he ever got to Rome, he must see this or that. So, Rounds said, "I don't dare go home without seeing this or that. My old man will kill me." With that much motivation, Rounds started reading up on the great artists. McGovern, meanwhile, learned of a special audience for American servicemen in the Vatican with the Pope. He persuaded Rounds to go with him. After standing around waiting for an hour, Rounds stage whispered to McGovern, "I'm getting the hell out of here." McGovern replied, "Look, this man is the head of state, and he's the symbol of the Catholic world, and you will feel very silly if you go back to the States and you haven't met the Pope." He talked Rounds into waiting 15 minutes. When that time was up, he asked him to stay for just 15 more minutes. "I wouldn't wait another 15 minutes for Jesus Christ," Rounds shot back. But he said it too loud, and it stirred up quite a commotion among the devout Catholic troops. There were 500 or so at the audience. The Pope did soon arrive and shook hands with every one. He spoke English and blessed each of them. Rounds said, "For the rest of my life, I'll tell people I saw and shook hands with the Pope." To McGovern, Rounds's desire to see all he could in Rome was an indication, a tiny one, that ours was the best educated army ever put into the field, and the best paid. We were paid way better than the British and enormously better than the Germans. I don't know if the Italian army ever got paid at all, or the Red Army either. In the U.S. Army infantry, there was a certain amount of resentment of the AAF officers and men. How could there not be? No ground trooper ever wore cowboy boots, not even on leave, certainly not when up on the line. No one in the infantry ever reported back from a leave 3 days late without being severely reprimanded or possibly subjected to a court-martial. And the ages of the lieutenants, even the ages of the captains and majors in the AAF, were astonishing to foot soldiers. At a bar in Rome, two infantry officers from the U.S. 5th Army, which was doing the fighting on the ground in Italy under the command of General Mark Clark, approached McGovern. One of them sat down on the stool next to McGovern, reached out, and flicked the wings on McGovern's jacket with his finger. "You fly boys think you're pretty hot stuff, don't you?" "No, not really," McGovern replied. "I think the 5th Army is doing a heck of a job, and I hope we can help." "Bull," the infantry officer responded. "You fly boys are just too good for us, aren't you?" McGovern resisted the temptation to hit the man. When the leave was over, it was back to Cerignola. For Lieutenant Pepin, a navigator, his first mission after returning was almost a disaster. It was on January 20. The target was the main marshalling yards at Linz, Austria. The flak was heavy. Shrapnel punctured some of his plane's hydraulic lines, and the pilot was unable to close the bomb bay doors or lower the landing gear, and could barely keep the Liberator in the air. He had managed to get back over Italy and close to Cerignola. He ordered the men to bail out. The plane was at 3,000 feet. "Petrified," Pepin related, "I was sitting with my feet hanging out of the bomb bay, afraid to jump, when the pilot pushed me into the wild blue yonder. Stark fear gripped me until my chute opened. The ground appeared to rush toward me, and fear came again. My landing was the same as taking a wicked body check from a big hockey player." He rolled over several times, got up, and discovered that he was unhurt. Ambulances from the base came around to pick him up. "Every member of my crew survived, and without injuries." On January 31, McGovern and his crew went up on a mission to bomb the oil refinery at Musbierbaum, Austria. There were 19 B-24s on the mission, each carrying 500-pound bombs. They encountered moderate but accurate flak and dropped on target. On this mission, as on all the others, the ground crew noted that Lieutenant McGovern brought back the Dakota Queen with more gasoline in his tanks than all the other pilots. In the ground crew's opinion, this was the mark of his flying ability. Ken Higgins remarked, "I don't know how you describe a good pilot. I do know George, though, and as far as I was concerned, he was the best, because he always got us back on the ground. Another member of McGovern's crew said, "If he ever panicked, I never knew about it. Whatever happened, that sort of nasal twang of his came over the intercom as clear and flat as it was on the ground." Valco disliked Siegel. He went to McGovern to ask him to get Siegel transferred out. McGovern put it up to the other enlisted men. "I decided they had to live with him," McGovern said, "so it was up to them to decide." The vote was 4-1 to drop Siegel. McGovern had him replaced with a tail gunner from another crew, Sergeant John B. Mills. Mills was tall, and he had to hunch up a bit to get into position, but he liked being back there in the tail. In February and March, McGovern would sometimes tell him to get out of the cramped quarters when the Dakota Queen was halfway back to base. "We're not going to see any fighter planes today," McGovern said, "so come on up and stretch out a bit." But Mills would be asleep. One good thing, according to McGovern, he didn't get sick. On one mission, with Sam Adams gone, McGovern had a substitute navigator bombardier. Weather forced his squadron to abort. The lead pilot said to jettison the bomb load. The standard procedure was to drop the bombs either over the Adriatic or an unpopulated area. Sergeant Tex Ashlock was watching the ground through the camera hatch when the bombardier let the bombs drop. They fell on a farmhouse. It disappeared in a rolling cloud of smoke. In Ashlock's mind, it was murder, pure and simple. When the Dakota Queen got back on the ground, Ashlock grabbed the bombardier. "Listen, you son of a bitch," he yelled. "I saw what you did. I'm not going to have anything to do with you again. As far as I'm concerned, you're a disgrace to humanity." When McGovern got out of the plane, Ashlock went to him to report what had happened. McGovern asked, "There isn't any doubt in your mind? It was deliberate?" "How could it not have been?" Ashlock replied. McGovern thought for a few minutes, then said, "You know, if we bring charges, it's going to be your word against his, an enlisted man against an officer. It's going to be hard to make it stick without any other evidence or witnesses." McGovern let that hang, then added, "I'll tell you one thing, though. We aren't going to fly with that guy again." And they didn't. For the 455th Group, according to its historical account, Flight of the Vulgar Vultures, January was our least productive month to date. Fewest missions flown, 7 in all, putting 168 bombers over targets, dropping a total of 200,035 tons of bombs. That was the lowest total since February 1944. The group could only hope for an improvement in the weather. Chapter 9. The Tuskegee Airmen Fly Cover. February 1945. February began with marginal weather. Then it got worse. The first mission for the 741st Squadron, on the first of the month, had as its target the oil refinery at Musbierbaum, Austria. But the weather was so bad, en route and at the target, that the group leader decided not to bomb. All planes returned to base. Oil refineries and the marshalling yards in Austria and Germany were the primary targets that month. On February 5, McGovern flew to bomb the oil storage facilities at Regensburg, Germany. Clouds covered the target, but the squadron dropped its bombs using the Pathfinder method of following the actions of the lead plane. The results were unobserved because of the clouds. No one in the squadron was lost. 2 days later, on another mission to Musbierbaum, the flight leader's bombsite was inoperative, so no bombs were dropped. The bombardiers dropped the bombs over water, then the planes returned safely. On February 8, 24 B-24s hit the Motzleindorf marshalling yards at Vienna. The clouds covered the target, but the Americans had dropped 54 tons of 500-pound bombs, again using the Pathfinder method. The flak was intense, but all the bombers made it through. However, one B-24 with the group's markings took a position off the number 2 man in one of the boxes. It was a plane that had been forced down, then repaired by the Germans. It shattered the squadron, radioing down to the gunners on the 88s the altitude, direction, and speed of the squadron, which was a practice that, while not frequent, was used whenever the Germans had the opportunity. The lead pilot realized what was happening and told every gunner in the squadron to train on the German manned B-24. As the gunners did so, the aircraft's pilot saw what was happening. He made a 180-degree turn and got out of there. By February 1945, the defensive capabilities of the Luftwaffe were almost non-existent. The Germans had little or no fuel left for training pilots, and their Me-109s had just about been blown out of the air. What fighters were left had few runways available. For his part, McGovern never saw a German fighter attack the Dakota Queen. Flak, of course, was another matter altogether. Following the Battle of the Bulge, as the Allies moved up the Rhine and prepared to cross the river, the Red Army was headed toward Berlin and Vienna. The shrinkage of the front lines forced the Germans to pull back. The American, British, and Russian air assaults on Germany were increasing in the number of bombers flown and damage done. So the Germans concentrated their 88s around their cities to defend their few remaining oil refineries and, most of all, their marshaling yards. That meant that even as the Allies were winning, their bombers were flying through ever heavier flak concentrations. And the Germans had developed a jet-propelled fighter, the Me-262, the fastest fighter in the world. Their problem was a shortage of fuel and trained pilots and airfields. Had the Me-262 been developed earlier, it could have been a war-winning weapon. But it was not. When a group of the jets attacked an 8th Air Force formation, it was havoc for the Americans, as the jets were three times faster than the American bombers. But that didn't happen very often. There were not enough of them. One reason for the shortage was the sustained 15th Air Force attack against factories making jets and against the airfields where they underwent final assembly. Altogether, the Germans built 1,400 jets, but only a small percentage of them got into the air. The Regensburg airfield was one of their bases. A photo reconnaissance by the 15th Air Force on February 8, 1945, showed 48 Me-262s on the ground. The 15th mounted missions to hit them on the field. The 455th and its 741st Squadron participated in the February attacks. The group destroyed 12 Me-262s and damaged four others. Other participants put more jets out of action. This proved to be a knockout blow. Individuals or small groups of jets continued to be seen, but no squadron-sized formations. Indeed, as the official Army Air Force's history put it, the few prize jet aircraft that appeared offered little opposition, but hopped almost comically from one airfield to another or to the empty Autobahnen behind German lines. Pilot Lieutenant Glenn Rendall in the 514th Squadron, 376th Bomb Group, flying out of San Pancrazio, Italy, near Taranto Bay, was attacked by Me-262s. In February 1945, he was on a mission to Austria when he had runaway turbo problems. He was over the Adriatic. The cure for the turbos, he related, was to move a good amplifier, after locking in its setting, from the slot for that engine into a slot in need of boost, then set and lock the desired setting there. He did so, but by the time he had fixed the problem, he had lost 5,000 feet of altitude and some speed. His formation was out of sight. We could never catch them, so we would just have to look for and join with another formation. As Rendall gained enough power to start climbing again, I took a look back over my left shoulder just as you would before you pull a car out of a parking place. As he did, oops, he saw two German jet fighters with black swastikas on their sides sweeping in from our left, and I saw their tracer bullets already coming into our plane. It was a favorite strategy for the German fighter pilots to catch stragglers flying alone. It was often an easy kill. Rendall called over the intercom, "Jerry's at 7 o'clock level. When are you guys going to start shooting back?" The upper turret gunner called back, "Hold your fire. Here comes three of our P-51 escorts from high overhead." With the P-51s coming at them, the Germans turned and ran, then dove for the ground of northern Yugoslavia just to the east. The three P-51 escorts stayed right on their tails until they all went out of sight. Rendall managed to hook up with another formation and added our bombing strength to their mission in what we regarded as a very useful contribution. Later, Rendall praised the P-51 pilots. If we had not had an escort trio watching us from above and timely enough to be there quite soon after the shooting started, we would have surely been subdued by two of the Nazis' latest jet fighters doing what they specialized in. Without the intervention of our escorts and their willingness to risk their lives for those of us whom they had never met, we would have been most fortunate to end up in the Adriatic Sea below us. Or we might have stretched it out to Trieste, which was then German-occupied. Most likely, some of our crew would be lost either way. The P-51 pilots were African-Americans of the 99th Fighter Squadron, 5th Air Force, flying out of Terni, north of Rome. They were called the Tuskegee Airmen, and they were justly famous. The men of the bombers seldom saw them because they stayed up high to watch over the formations. As Rendall put it, "When you needed them, they came, and with a full head of steam." He called the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen exemplary. He felt that their vigilant watch over us that day saved 10 of us from a potential tragedy. We, plus all our families, will forever be grateful to them. He added, "The important thing is that when our nation goes to war, real patriotism has only one race. You are either American or you're not. There are those who want to kill you, and then there are those who want to save your life. It is that simple and undeniable." Lieutenant Roland Pepin of the 741st Squadron spoke for many. "It was a favorable day for us when we caught escort protection from the men of the 99th Fighter Squadron. Because of the P-51's long-range capabilities, they were able to escort us to and from most of the targets. It was quite a vision to observe these great pilots engage the German jets and prevent them from attacking us. We would watch them as they dispersed the enemy with their superior skills. They never let the Germans get close enough for our gunners to fire at the enemy." "Unfortunately," Pepin added, "they could give us no protection from the flak. We just had to plow through and pray a good deal." The U.S. Army in World War II was a segregated force. In Pepin's words, it was still practicing discrimination, but those P-51 Negro fighter pilots did not discriminate. Once, late that winter, Pepin was in Foggia when he and his buddies met some of the 99th Fighter Squadron pilots. "We showered them with our thanks and respect. The drinks were on us." The men of Tuskegee admired the B-24 pilots and crews without stint. Lieutenant Edward Gleed said, "We didn't want any part of that flak the bombers flew through. It was a horrendous sight to see six B-24 Liberators with all that flak starting to come up, and bang, there's only 5 airplanes left and 1 big ball of smoke." Lieutenant Herb Shepherd said his most vivid memory of the war was the sight of bombers being hit by an 88 and the bombs going off, a big red eruption with black smoke going by you. Lieutenant Jefferson recalled, "Planes fell in flames, planes fell not in flames. An occasional one pulled out and crash-landed, sometimes successfully, sometimes they blew up. Men fell in flames, men fell in parachutes. Some candlesticked when their parachutes didn't open. Pieces of men dropped through the hole, pieces of planes." The Tuskegee Airmen prayed and wept. Have you any idea of what it's like to vomit in an oxygen mask? According to Jefferson, these bomber guys had seen the inside of hell. The African-American pilots loved their P-51s. Lieutenant Woody Crockett called the plane a dream. It could climb, turn, and fight at low level and at high altitude. The Mustang carried 6 50-caliber machine guns, 3 on each wing. Lieutenant Lou Purnell said, "If that plane had been a girl, I'd have married it right on the spot. Damn right, it was like dancing with a good partner." They painted their tails bright red. Lieutenant Herbert Carter explained, "We wanted the American bombers to know we were escorting them. The red tails would also let the German interceptors know who was escorting those bombers." Their task was to protect. Their orders were to stay with the bombers, whatever happened. "Protect them with your life," was the saying. They flew about 5,000 feet above the bombers, meaning they flew at 30,000 feet or even above. Lieutenant Shepard felt, "The extra 5,000 feet gave us an edge if we had to ward off attack. If you have speed, you can get altitude. And if you have altitude, you can get speed. That P-51 really accelerated when you put its nose down. Man, altitude just disappeared like smoke in the wind." On a February mission, McGovern heard in his briefing that the 99th would fly as escorts. After dropping the bombs and turning for home, he looked out the window and saw German jets looming in the distance. "Our group leader tried to establish radio contact with our fighter escorts," McGovern said, "but couldn't. There was some pretty harsh language on the air, questions about where the blasted niggers were." Just then, the squadron commander of the Black Pilots broke in and said, "Why don't you all shut up, white boys? We're all going to take you home." And they did. They drove off the enemy fighters. Ken Higgins looked out and saw the P-51s flying at the side of the Dakota Queen. The Black Pilot saw the camera in the camera hatch and called up on the radio. "Is that a camera in there?" Higgins said, "Yes." And the pilot said, "How about taking my picture?" Higgins did. Over the radio, he heard some fighter pilots talking. "Red Tail 1 to Red Tail 2, is that you behind me?" Another voice, "Who that?" And the first voice, "Who that? Who say that?" The colonel in the lead B-24 cut in, "Get off the radio. No speaking on the radio. Get off." The fighter pilot came back on. "Who that?" he asked. In Higgins's view, that would keep you going, you know. A little levity here and there didn't hurt. Like Pepin and everyone else in one of the bombers, Higgins had the deepest respect for the men of the 99th. He pointed out that, among many other things, they made it a point when they were in a town, they were dressed immaculately. I mean, their brass was polished and their clothes were pressed. They were really sharp. They made it a point to be that way. Higgins added, "There was a lot of talk during the war about blacks being cowards and stuff like that. I never saw any of that. Never did I see any cowardliness." Neither did anyone else. Sergeant Erling Kindom of the 742nd Squadron was on a February mission against Vienna. He later wrote in his war diary, "Before reaching the target, a Phantom B-24 joined our formation. It was a downed bomber the Germans had restored and were flying to radio back to base the formation's altitude, speed, and direction. Fortunately, the Tuskegee airmen were flying as escort." Kindom's pilot reported to the black pilots in their P-51s the information. The leader responded, "I'll go scare him out, but you tell your boys not to point their guns at us." Kindom's diary went on, "The P-51s came in, and over the radio, the German Phantom pilot said he was from the 55th Wing and got lost. But the 55th Wing wasn't flying that day, and the plane had no tail markings. The fighter pilot squadron leader gave him some bursts from his guns and warned the Phantom to turn back. He added, 'You will be escorted.' The German pilot replied that he could make it alone. The P-51 pilot said, 'You are going to be escorted whether you want it or not. You are going to have two men on your tail all the way back, and don't try to land in Yugoslavia.' The Phantom protested and said he wanted to drop his bombs. The response from the fighter pilot was, 'You ain't going to drop no bombs.' The Phantom left with his escort, and we heard nothing further from the event." Back in October 1944, Lieutenant C.W. Cooper, the old infantry officer, he was 28 years old, who had, after some time with the troops, volunteered for the Army Air Forces and trained as a navigator, shipped over to join the 741st Squadron at Cerignola. It was a long trip by a leaky cargo ship. He was in command of 55 replacements, all soon to be crew members of the B-24s. "They were hell to take care of," he recalled, not like the infantry enlisted men he was accustomed to leading. After disembarking at Naples, Cooper and his men traveled by truck to a staging base in southernmost Italy. They arrived in November. The first officer he saw was a big, raw-boned second lieutenant with red hair and a red beard. I said, "Golly, that guy's still a second lieutenant. He must be 35 years old. Cooper and his crew boarded the lieutenant's B-24 and flew toward Cerignola. As they were landing, Cooper heard the lieutenant say to his co-pilot, "Have you got runway on your side?" The co-pilot said, "Yeah." The pilot said, "I've got some over here, too." So he set the plane down. Later, when the pilot had completed his missions, he shaved, and to Cooper's astonishment, he was an 18-year-old kid. Cooper and the crew lined up for their first meal at Cerignola. The man in front of Cooper asked, "You haven't eaten here before, have you?" "No," Cooper replied. "Well, we've been eating here quite a while," the man said. "Tell you what you're supposed to do. If you have a bug in your food when you get it, first you throw the food out. After about a week, though, if you have a bug in your food, you go ahead and eat the food. And then the third week, you look and there's a bug in your food, you make him stay and don't let it get away because it's good. It's got nutrients." On an early mission, Cooper's plane climbed well above freezing altitude. I think our bombardier may have been reading a comic book or sleeping back there. Anyway, when you go through the level where things will freeze, you keep working the bomb bay doors so that they don't jam on you. They won't ice up. Cooper's plane got to the target, and the bombardier hadn't done what he should have done going to that level, and the bomb bay doors had frozen. He couldn't get them open. So he dropped the bombs through the bomb bay doors. In other words, he hit the toggle switch and the bombs just broke through the aluminum. The wheels, when let down, were below the now broken bomb bay doors flapping in the breeze. We didn't know whether it would be enough room or not. If those things hit the runway, they may cause a spark, and there may be a buildup of gas in the bomber, and bloody we would have had it. Fortunately, the plane landed safely. Cooper was so good as a navigator that he soon was flying on the lead plane on his missions. He did so on 6 missions. The pressure was really on then, because you had to be absolutely right where you were supposed to be at all times. I was the navigator. He was struck by the difference between being an infantry officer and a pilot. The pilot didn't exercise command like an infantry platoon leader, he felt. In the infantry, you're under pressure all the time. For us, we were only under pressure when going on a mission. In the infantry, a lieutenant told his platoon what to do and how to go about it. But the pilot had to recognize the role of each air crew member and not get in the way. Cooper thought the biggest difference between the infantry and the Army Air Forces was that you are individuals when you're on a crew. The pilot's not going to tell me how to navigate. He's not going to tell Ken Higgins how to run his radio. Those were our specialties, and we did our job. Cooper added, it was a whole different situation than it was in the infantry. B-24 crews socialized together, mixing regardless of rank. Never had Cooper seen such a thing in the infantry. Cooper had 11 missions behind him. Compounding the tension of navigating the lead plane, with 6 other navigators watching in their following planes, was the reality of flak. On nearly every mission, his plane took various hits, losing power on 1 or 2 engines, and in other ways making what he was doing in the most dangerous place in the world even more fearful. So was the possibility of accidents. One time, Cooper saw a B-24 drop its bombs right on top of a plane flying below, setting off a flashing explosion that destroyed everything except the engines. Cooper watched as they fell. A few days later, Cooper flew a mission, got back to Cerignola, and was told to make up a route for the mission the next day. I noticed that one of the turning points they gave us was right over a flak-up area in northern Yugoslavia, so I thought, that's no good. He called wing headquarters. Say, you gave us a wrong turning point. Don't say any more, the officer at wing shot out. Don't say any more. Our telephone lines are bugged all the time, so no more. We will get you a correction. The men at wing headquarters had already spotted the error, which had come about because 2 towns in Yugoslavia had the same name. One had heavy flak, the other nothing. The turning point was changed. Radio men on the B-24s kept changing their frequencies so that the Germans would have a hard time listening. Occasionally, they could pick up and get on the German frequency. On one of Cooper's missions, a German-speaking radio man came along. Cooper listened as he went to work. He got on the radio, on their frequency, and he heard a German commander talking to his fighter planes, directing them toward our formation. So the American, identifying himself in German as their ground control officer, ordered them return to base immediately. So these fighter planes took off to go back to base, and before their real commander could get it corrected, they were already gone and couldn't get back up there to us. Cooper added to the story that he knew of at least one other native German speaker in the 455th group who used that technique. One of the pilots Cooper flew with was, in his view, wishing he were up in the sky in fighter planes, not B-24s. He took chances in turns, wagging his wings, climbing or diving. One February day, when Cooper was not on the plane, that pilot took it up for a practice run. As a stunt, he began buzzing Wing headquarters. Wing called group headquarters on the radio to say, "There's a plane buzzing us, and it's your plane. Get this damn plane out of here." The group commander, furious, ordered, "Ground that pilot when he gets back to base. Nobody in his right mind would do that." Even before the B-24 landed, there was a jeep waiting for the pilot. Cooper recalled that they took him into headquarters and grounded him right there on the spot, and they kept him grounded for quite a while, and then when they did let him fly again on a combat mission, they gave him a plane that was doubtful whether it'd get up there or not. The day the pilot was grounded, Cooper was moved out of his tent and out of his crew and sent to George McGovern's tent. From now on, he would take Adams' place permanently as McGovern's navigator. The next night, February 19, he wrote his buddy, Lieutenant Joe Prendergast, with the 4th Infantry in Germany. He told Prendergast, "My new pilot is a honey, very sincere, a mature man, and a good pilot. He's married and expecting a baby in 3 weeks, so he'll add 1,000 feet for safety." As Cooper signed off on the letter, McGovern came into the tent. He had just been promoted to first lieutenant. Cooper added a postscript. "Mac, my new pilot, just came in and let me pin his 30-minute-old silver bars on him. I'm sure glad, 'cause he rates." Sometime after sending the letter, Cooper got the V-mail back. Scribbled on the front, beside Prendergast's name, was a note. "Killed in action. J. A. Wesolowski, Captain, 4th Infantry." When Cooper met McGovern and Rounds, he knew he had joined an experienced pilot and co-pilot. He went through details of what he had done up to that point, then listened. He was impressed by McGovern. Serious without being obnoxious. Rounds had more of a wait-and-see quality to him. Cooper later said that Rounds would go in all directions at once. I quickly called him Rounds the Rounder. On February 20, McGovern and his crew stood down. The next morning, at 4 a.m., they were up, getting ready. The briefing officer informed them the target that day was the marshaling yards in Vienna. He was answered with groans. Vienna still had one of the heaviest flak concentrations in Europe. Among the bomber crews in the formation was one with Lieutenant Hammer as radio man. He had had a dream the previous night, which he related to his crew as they were waiting to take off. He had dreamed that the target would be Vienna, and it turned out to be true. The other crew members, Hammer confessed, were amused in a sickly sort of way. Off they went anyway, along with 26 other B-24s. The Dakota Queen was in the middle of the 741st Squadron's box. The flak over Vienna was, according to the 455th Group's account, intense and accurate. Some 14 of the bombers were hit out of the 21 that got over the target. Hammer was in one of them. As the plane pulled away from Vienna, number 3 engine quit. Lieutenant Ray Grooms, the pilot, and Lieutenant Jim Connolly, the co-pilot, tried unsuccessfully to feather the propeller. The windmilling prop cost the plane altitude and speed, and it dropped behind the remainder of the squadron. Grooms ordered the crew to jettison everything possible, but still the plane lost altitude and just did get over the Yugoslavian mountains. Grooms decided not to try to cross the Adriatic. His navigator told him there was an emergency landing field under American control at Zara, just ahead. He headed for it, but as he checked his systems, he discovered that the hydraulic system had been damaged. He had no brakes. He snapped out orders to his waist gunners. Remove the waist windows. Tie a parachute to each waist gun. Be ready to toss it out and pull the ripcords on my word. They acknowledged. In Hammer's words, shortly after the wheels made contact with the ground, we got the word and threw them out and pulled ripcords. The one on my side opened first, and we veered crazily in that direction until the pintle holding the waist gun to its mounting was sheared cleanly in half. The pintle, made of solid steel, measured 2 inches in diameter at the point of breakage. The other parachute finally opened and braked us down. Once out of the plane, the crew members told Hammer that I could, in the future, keep my dreams to myself. GIs in trucks and jeeps picked them up and took them immediately to a C-47, which was soon in the air. Hammer and his buddies got to sleep in their own bunks that night, back in Chirignola. The Dakota Queen had taken only a few hits from shrapnel, which made holes in the wings, but McGovern was on the ground to welcome Hammer back. On February 24, McGovern, Rounds, Cooper, and the crew flew a mission headed toward the marshalling yards in Vienna. But bad weather forced them and the other planes to abort. On the 28th, it was back into the air, with the target, the marshalling yards in Isarco Albis in northern Italy. The flak was not as heavy as over Vienna, but it was there. They returned to Chirignola safely. In the winter of 1944 to 1945, the 741st improved its living conditions. By then, every tent had either a wooden or a concrete floor. The food was better and had come to include steak, fresh chicken, real eggs, and ice cream. Squadron officers started to give classes in algebra, business administration, aircraft maintenance, history, and the Italian languages. The ground crews flocked to the Italian instructions, as they had come to the conclusion that since there was no hope in their going home before war's end, they might as well understand what the natives were talking about. Still, the rain came down. It created much mud, especially around the new mess hall. 2 GIs were heard discussing the mud. One said he had stumbled into it and had sunk in ankle deep. The other GI said he had gone in as well, but the mud was up to his knees. The first GI said, "Yeah, but I went in head first." The men put out a group newspaper called the Journal, and each squadron also had one. The 740th Squadron's was called Il Castoro Ardente, meaning Eager Beaver. The 741st called its paper Stag Rag. The papers were typed and run off on hand-cranked mimeograph machines. The January 1945 issue of the Journal carried an article written by Major Al Coons, the group intelligence officer. 1 year had passed, he opened. A year that most of us would rather not have lived as we did, had the world we inherited been one in which free choices were possible. At the same time, it is a year most of us would not have spent otherwise, given the world as it was in February 1944. He then wrote of all the territory liberated in Russia, France, Belgium, and elsewhere, and noted that the 15th Air Force had made its contribution to the victories. He gave credit for this accomplishment to the pilots and their crews, to the ground crews, to the clerks, cooks, communications personnel, and all the rest. But, Coons went on, all of us have a responsibility for the failures, the briefings that were inadequate, the truck drivers who were late in getting the crews to their briefings, the crew members who stayed in the pad when they should have been familiarizing themselves with their planes or their guns or their targets, the cooks who didn't have breakfast on time, and the linemen who failed to check the plane carefully. These failures have softened the blows against the enemy. They have cost the lives of Americans and our allies. Coons concluded, all that we have learned in 1 year of combat can be used to ensure that the second year will be a short one. The Journal carried one article about Demo, who was the first mascot of the 742nd Squadron. Demo had flown from Africa when he was just a puppy. Demo refused to leave the empty tent when his masters failed to return from their mission. Broken-hearted, waiting. Demo never went hungry. Someone always remembered and carried food to the little soldier on guard. McGovern wrote an article called This Thing Called Spirit for the second issue of Stag Rag. He gave various tips on how to keep morale high. First of all, he wrote, we can make sure that we don't go stale on life. We can keep alive and interested in what is going on around us. The army has plenty of Joes who exist just to eat, sleep, and bitch. He urged his readers to keep posted on the war fronts and on developments in the States, to read bestsellers, of which the squadron is well supplied. Try to improve personalities by using a little tact and thought in our relations with others. Plan post-war careers, and even write for Stag Rag. A second aid to good spirit is to refuse to let our bitches and troubles get us down. He concluded that our primary source of satisfaction comes from being true to ourselves and the best that is in us. The finest praise any man can receive is to be satisfied himself with what he has accomplished. Combat may be rough, but it won't be half as rough if we go through it in the right spirit. Let's make it easy on ourselves. February 12, 1945, was the first anniversary for the 455th Group flying out of Italy. On February 22, it flew its 200th mission. It came at the end of 13 consecutive days of combat flying. The Dakota Queen had gone out on five of them. Group Commander Colonel William Snowden led the wing over Linz. It was a common practice in the 455th for a major or a colonel, sometimes even a general, to fly the lead. Old Teepee Time Gal flew her 100th mission over Linz. By early 1945, she plus Glamour Gal and Best We Do were the only B-24s left out of the original 24. Despite the losses, in its second 100 missions, the 455th dropped 4,412 tons of bombs in 2,521 sorties. Bombing accuracy was improving. In the period from December 1944 through February 1945, the group greatly exceeded the average performance of the 15th Air Force as a whole, but a total of 47 bombers had been lost, mostly to flak. Considering that the group put up 60 B-24s for its 101st mission, those losses were high. Shortly after the 200th mission, the group had a party to celebrate. Italian laborers put up tents and bandstands. Entertainers were hired to perform. The airmen pitched in to do their specialties. There were shows of all types, contortionists, muscle acts, rifle ranges, ring games, and variety shows. Four different movies were shown in the wine cellar used for the mission briefing room. There was plenty of beer. It was a chance to relax, eagerly seized by these airmen, far from home and living dangerous lives. For that day, at least, they could be the boys they were. February was over. The 455th Group had flown 26 missions, 7 aborted. It had put 505 aircraft over the targets and dropped 840 tons of bombs. It lost 5 B-24s that month and had 41 men missing in action, one man killed in action in a plane that got back to base, and 16 severely wounded. The history of the group comments, with weather conditions as they were, it speaks highly of the support given by the ground echelon as well as the effort put forth by the crews. With better weather on the horizon, things would only get better. Chapter 10. Missions over Austria. March 1945. In the first 2 weeks of March, the 455th flew 13 missions, five of them aborted due to weather. On another three, the bombers went after alternate targets when the primary was socked in. Marshalling yards were generally the target. Occasionally, the bombers went after refineries. The Dakota Queen was part of the force on March 4 when the target was marshalling yards at Wiener Neustadt, Austria. On this mission, McGovern saw a B-24 flying on his wing just peel off in flames. The plane took a hit right near the fuselage, and the number 3 engine broke off. The plane just went into a spinning fall. Didn't see any chutes. On that mission, ball turret gunner Sergeant William McAfee, who had just turned 21, got unplugged from his electric suit. McGovern called on the intercom to check on the crew, and McAfee informed him that he had no heat. He told McAfee to come up to the cockpit because you'll freeze to death back there. Hesitant to get into the cockpit, McAfee instead changed shoes with waist gunner Ashlock and radio man Higgins. I'd just stick my foot in their shoes long enough to get it thawed out a little bit, then I'd give it back to them. McGovern kept checking on him until assured that he was okay. In a 1999 interview, McAfee recalled the incident, then commented, McGovern took good care of me. That was one thing he did. He was like an old mother. He was supposed to bring us back in one piece, and he did. McGovern, at age 22, was a year or more older than everyone on the crew except Cooper and Falco. But he was responsible, and he knew, and he had learned to respond to that. As McAfee said, we were much, much too young to even know anything about what was going on or anything. We did what McGovern told us to do, and that's all. McGovern, in his autobiography, Grassroots, wrote, the members of my crew were boys when we entered combat. They emerged as serious men. He felt that they, like hundreds of others, were welded into a highly competent team by their common yearning to survive. McGovern had his own special reason to survive. On March 5, Cooper wrote a letter home. My new crew and I get along swell, he said. Mac is still sweating out a cable telling of a new son or daughter. Still sweating out his mission so's to get home. About this time, McGovern had a snapshot taken of himself standing outside his tent. C.W. Cooper sent a copy back to his fiancée. On the back of the picture, he wrote, the best B-24 pilot in the world. McGovern never would accept such a judgment. He knew there were better pilots than he in the 741st, starting with Lieutenant Charles Painter, and certainly in the 455th. Painter, McGovern said, was a big guy. One thing I remember about those pilots is that most of them were big and had been athletes. I was one of the few skinny debaters who had never been an athlete. Still, it was good to have the approval of one of the old men of the crew, especially when Cooper was a former infantry officer and now one of the top navigators in the Army Air Forces. After the March 4 mission, McGovern stayed on the ground for 9 days. There was little to do but wait. And yet you had to be available to fly every day, even though you didn't get off the ground. You had a lot of time to think. For one thing, he wondered why the Germans didn't surrender. He knew they had been beaten, if only because they did not have sufficient fuel to keep their fighter planes in the air. When you were on missions, you had no time to think. You're so busy handling that plane and staying in formation and watching the fuel supply, making sure the gauges are not giving any trouble, that it really kept you occupied. You had to keep all four of those engines working, synchronized, proper oil pressure, temperature, and keeping that big bomber in formation at all times. You had about all you could handle. In a sense, the pilot was insulated from the war. You had a perfect view of the flak. You could see the puffs out in front of you, the flashes of red and black. You could feel the plane shudder better than anyone else. So you knew there was a war going on, but you had only an indirect relationship to what was being done by the bomber. You couldn't see the target, and you were 25,000 feet away from the action on the ground. There was the explosion of the flak shells all around you, but you had no weapon to shoot back with, and you didn't have the toggle switch. You didn't have the navigator's view of where you were going. Recalling his mission over Vienna on February 21, McGovern said that, until then, he had felt a sort of nagging and anxiety on takeoffs and turbulent air, and hoping that all the mechanics were working right. But on that day, everything seemed to go smoothly, and it just dawned on me that I had largely overcome any fear that I had previously had about flying. As Cooper had remarked, and as every crew member of the Dakota Queen later testified, McGovern was a serious, mature officer. The responsibilities he carried on every mission, for that big, expensive plane, for getting it over the target tightly packed into the formation, for the lives of his crew, were much bigger and more serious than 22-year-old men ever carry in civilian life. But there was a war on, and those were his responsibilities. Lieutenant Commander Edgar D. Hoagland, USNR, a PT boat skipper and later commander of a squadron of PT boats at an age when he should have been going to college, spoke for all pilots, infantry company and platoon leaders, and naval skippers when he wrote in his war memoir, "A destroyer of anxiety and fear is the fierce, overwhelming desire to take care of your men. The more responsibility you have in a combat situation, the easier it is to remain cool and resolute. Fear is more than balanced out by the exhilaration of danger, which puts every sense on full alert and makes you feel supremely alive. Then, after conquering a dangerous situation, you are left fulfilled and confident beyond description." Eleanor was due to have her baby in mid-March. McGovern wrote to her and she to him every day, but it took more than a week for the letters to be delivered. On March 14, McGovern and his crew were awakened at 4 a.m. The stars were out. It promised to be a clear, bright day. After breakfast, they walked over to the briefing room and joined about 300 other airmen to sit on the planks laid across cinder blocks. The target that was marked this time was Vienna. The alternate target, also marked, was Wiener Neustadt. If Vienna was clear, the bombs should be dropped on an oil refinery. If it was not, and Wiener Neustadt became the choice, the target was marshalling yards. The weather officer took over. He described the conditions between Cirignola and Vienna, and what to expect for the target. He said there could be a storm over the city, or on the way to it, and the clouds might build too high for the formation to fly over them. If that proved to be the case, the alternate would be bombed. He thought the weather conditions over Wiener Neustadt might be better. He described the weather conditions to expect on the way home. Another officer mounted the platform to tell the airmen what they were going after and why. He explained the need to hit the refineries or, if necessary, the marshalling yards. If it was Vienna, he told them to stay well away from St. Stephen's Cathedral, the Opera House, the Palace, and other historic buildings and schools. At Wiener Neustadt, the marshalling yards carried north-south rail traffic, moving to Munich, Vienna, or elsewhere. Group Commander Colonel William Snowden would lead the mission, which was about the first piece of news that morning that pleased everyone. The last briefing was on how to form up. At the hard stand, McGovern inspected his plane as his crew got in. Then he pulled himself up and climbed into the pilot's seat. The Dakota Queen taxied, took off, began to climb and circle over the Adriatic, and after an hour of flying, having reached 20,000 feet, got into formation. There were 42 B-24s, 21 from the 455th Bomb Group, 21 from the 454th. They flew as squadrons, 7 planes in each, in a diamond formation. They set off for Vienna, still gaining altitude to 25,000 feet. The day was clear until the formation started to approach Vienna, but over the city the weather had built up into a storm, and Colonel Snowden decided it was too dangerous to risk losing his bombers when he couldn't see the target, which also added the additional hazard of possibly hitting the monuments in the city or schools and hospitals. He began a slow 180-degree turn toward the alternate. That made every pilot and his crew following Snowden happy. Vienna, as usual, meant heavy and accurate flak, while there would be none at all at Wiener Neustadt. There was some cloud cover at Wiener Neustadt, but Snowden's radar could pick up the marshalling yards. Everyone dropped their bombs right after he did, and the formation turned for home. It would be a milk run. But in the middle of the turn, Sergeant Higgins called up to Lieutenant McGovern on the intercom. The last of the 10 500-pound bombs they were carrying had lodged in the bomb rack. McGovern thought about it for a minute. Landing the Dakota Queen in that situation would be suicide. "Well, look, we can't land this way with a live bomb in the rack. Either you guys got to get rid of the bomb, or we're going to have to bail out when we get back within reasonable distance of Cirignola. I'm not going to take this bomber down with a bomb in the rack." The crew left the bomb bay doors open, and Sergeant McAfee and Lieutenant Cooper went to work, trying to trigger the little steel catches on each end of the bomb, hoping to pry them open so the bomb would drop. McGovern remembered, "It was scary as hell. if the plane suddenly made a lunge when the 500-pound bomb dropped. McAfee and Cooper were doing their work, standing on the catwalk, less than a foot wide, hanging in the center of the bomb bay. McGovern looked behind him to see how they were doing, but about all I could see was the top of their heads and their backs. The danger was acute. McGovern had heard the story told by Sergeant Art Applin, a tail gunner on a B-24. Once, after turning away from a mission over Munich, Applin had seen a Liberator on his wing. The bomb bay doors were open. As Applin related, one of the crew was standing right at the end of the catwalk, relieving himself out of the bomb bay, and an .88 shell exploded below him, and it cracked the catwalk, and he fell out. When he did, the heel of his foot got caught in this crack, and I saw him dangling there, and I called the pilot on the intercom. I couldn't communicate with the plane on the wing, but our pilot could. I told him about the situation, and he called the pilot on the other plane, and his crew pulled the fellow in. Naturally, he didn't have his parachute on. He was lucky he made it that day. As McAfee and Cooper labored, McGovern throttled back to slow down the Dakota Queen, and they began to lose altitude. "I didn't want to drop a bomb in front of other airplanes," he explained. "Also, I wanted to give McAfee and Cooper undivided time. I didn't know how long it would take to get rid of the bomb. Keep in mind that I had to know all this stuff to survive, whereas the other guys, their feeling was, George will take care of us." The Dakota Queen descended to 12,000 feet, several thousand feet below the formation, which was pulling ahead in any case. Then Cooper yelled something. All of a sudden, the plane jumped, and I knew the bomb had been cut loose. They were approaching the Austrian-Italian border. McGovern watched the bomb descend, a luxury you don't have at 25,000 feet. It went down and hit right on a farm in that beautiful green part of Austria. It was almost like a mushroom, a big, gigantic mushroom. It just withered the house, the barn, the chicken house, the water tank. Everything was just leveled. It couldn't have come in more perfectly. If we had been trying to hit it, we couldn't have hit it as square. You could see stuff flying through the air and a cloud of black smoke. Sergeant Higgins watched the bomb descend. He commented, "It just blew that farm to smithereens. We didn't mean to do that. We certainly didn't try to do that." McGovern glanced at his watch. It was high noon. He came from South Dakota. He knew what time farmers eat. "I got a sickening feeling. Here was this peaceful area. They thought they were safely out of the war zone. Nothing there, no city, no rail yard, nothing. Just a peaceful farmyard. Had nothing to do with the war, just a family eating a noon meal. It made me sick to my stomach." Navigator Lieutenant Roland Pepin had a similar experience. On a bombing run over Munich, the last bomb in his plane got stuck. "We were on our return, flying over the Alps. The crew chief and the bombardier were successful in releasing the bomb. I viewed it descending and watched in horror as it landed in the center of a small village and destroyed it. It was a Sunday, mid-morning, and I could not help but feel the deepest remorse and shameful guilt for the people of the village. Following this mishap, I couldn't sleep. I was in a stupor and couldn't get those innocent people out of my mind. I was cracking up and didn't know it. My pilot, Lieutenant Barnhill, ordered me to drink about half a bottle of whiskey. I passed out and slept for 18 hours. Other members of the crew felt as I did. We were all getting jumpy and tired. The surgeon ordered us to take 10 days off on the Isle of Capri." After the bomb fell, McGovern closed the bomb bay doors and headed home. On the intercom, he and Cooper talked. McGovern asked, "What's the highest elevation between here and where we're going?" Cooper looked at his map, did his calculations, and replied, 8,000 feet, George, 8,000 feet. In an interview, he admitted, "Actually, it was only 7,000 feet, but I added another 1,000 feet because I was engaged to get married." Cooper grinned, then added, "As George was expecting his first child, he added another 1,000 feet on top of that." Back at Chirignola, it was an easy landing. There had been no flak on the milk run over Wiener Neustadt. There was not even a scratch on the Dakota Queen. No one had been hurt. McGovern jumped into a truck and rode over to the debriefing area where the Red Cross women gave him coffee and a donut. An intelligence officer came running up to him, the same officer who had handed him a cable back in December that told him his father had died. This time, however, the officer was grinning from ear to ear. As he handed a cable to McGovern, he said, "Congratulations, Daddy, you now have a baby daughter." The cable was from Eleanor. Their first baby, whom she named Anne Marion, had been born 4 days before, on March 10, in the Mitchell Methodist Hospital. Eleanor concluded the cable, "Child doing well. Love, Eleanor." "I was just ecstatic," McGovern said, "jubilant." But then he thought, "Eleanor and I have brought a new child into the world today, at least I learned about it today, and I probably killed somebody else's kids right at lunchtime. Hell, why did that bomb have to hit there?" He went over to the officers' club and had a drink, cheap red wine. He was toasted and cheered, but he later said, "It really did make me feel different for the rest of the war. Now I was a father. I had not only a wife back home, but a little girl. All the more reason why I wanted to get home and see that child." He returned to his tent and wrote Eleanor a long letter. He did not mention the farmhouse, but he couldn't get it out of his mind. "That thing stayed with me for years and years. If I thought about the war, almost invariably, I would think about that farm." 2 days after the mission to Wiener Neustadt, the Dakota Queen flew again with the 455th, accompanied by the 454th. The primary target was weathered in, so the liberators dropped their bombs on the marshaling yards at Amstetten, Austria. The lead bomber, using its radar and flying out in front and a bit above the Dakota Queen, dropped its bombs. Cooper, acting as bombardier as well as navigator, tried to toggle his bombs so that they would strike in the same place. But the bombs were stuck. Cooper went to work and managed to free them. But by the time he toggled the eggs on the Dakota Queen, it had flown over the river. The bombs landed on the other side. At the debriefing, Cooper told what had happened and why. He was informed that the bombs had dropped on a prisoner of war camp. Cooper and McGovern were devastated. There were American soldiers in the camp. For some months thereafter, just thinking about it brought tears to Cooper's eyes. But in 1946, when Cooper was going to graduate school at Texas A&M, he met an Army Air Forces officer who had been a prisoner in the camp. They got to talking about the incident, and the former POW said, "I was there, and when you dropped those bombs, one hit the fence. It opened it up, and in all the confusion, some of us got away and managed to join the Russians." 3 days later, McGovern and his crew flew again. The target was the marshaling yards at Mühldorf, Germany. The group dropped over 116 tons of bombs with good results. Over 55% fell within 1,000 feet of the aiming point. There was no flak. On March 21, it was back up into the sky, the third day in a row for the group, McGovern's second mission in 3 days. Some 94 tons of bombs were dropped with outstanding accuracy. Over 87% fell within 1,000 feet of the aiming point. The following day, March 22, it was up again. Target, the oil refinery at Kralupy, Czechoslovakia, the group being escorted by P-51s. The formation got to within 125 miles of Berlin. The next day, Cooper described what had happened in a note home. "It had been a long mission," he said, "altogether taking 8 hours and 20 minutes after spending an hour forming up. When we got back to the place we could come down from altitude," he wrote, "we had been on oxygen for 4.5 hours, and our supply was almost exhausted. There wasn't any real danger, because any time Mac wants to come down from altitude, I know the area well enough I can bring him around all the flak. Funny, he doesn't worry when I'm navigating, and I never worry when he's the pilot. Several times he's proved what a cool-headed and superior pilot he is." On March 25, the group took off for its seventh straight day of flying missions. The Dakota Queen was there. McGovern's fifth flight since March 16. It was his 26th mission, 5 ahead of the crew. The target was a tank factory in Prague, Czechoslovakia. 36 liberators dropped 96 tons of bombs with good results. Flak was moderate but accurate. Three aircraft were hit, but managed to get back to Cerignola. Cooper wrote, "After yesterday's mission, Mac said he was lucky he got me, and trusts me, doesn't worry when I'm with him. I feel the same way about him, so we make a good team. I put him in for the DFC, the Distinguished Flying Cross, for a couple of planes he's brought back safe." That didn't work, as McGovern already had a DFC. On March 31, Cooper was relaxing in the officers' club, sitting in an easy chair, daydreaming. Another officer came in and told him, "Congratulations." He had just won a $500 war bond. He explained to his mother that it came as a result of an Easter drive drawing. Each member of the squadron selected a number between 1 and 375 and paid a dollar. "I selected the number of the plane that has been damaged a couple of times and brought Mac and the crew home safely. It was the last three numbers of the serial number of the bomber, 279. I hope the luck holds as well in the air as it did on the ground." March was over. The group had flown 26 missions, putting 719 aircraft over the target areas, and dropped 1,376 tons of bombs. No enemy fighters had been seen, but two aircraft had been shot down by flak. In addition, six crew members had been severely wounded, while three others had minor wounds. The group's history commented, "The concentration of flak around the major targets seemed to be increasing as the Germans appeared to be circling their wagons for the final attacks."